Hello and welcome to Last Week on Earth with Gary. Today's guest is Frank Sauer. Frank is a senior research fellow at Bundeswehr University Munich and the head of research at the Metis Institute for Strategy and Foresight. He currently serves as a senior advisor on the International Panel on the Regulation of Autonomous Weapons and is a subject matter expert in the Commission on the Responsible Use of Technologies in the European Future Combat Air System. He is also a leading member of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control, one of the founding NGOs of the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. He regularly sits with the UN on discussions around nuclear, cyber, and autonomous weapons. Please subscribe, share, and enjoy. What has happened in the last week that piqued your interest?
I read a thing just this morning that caught my eye, and it is about the National Institute of Standards in the US, the NIST, which is currently running like a competition for the next best solution to come up regarding quantum computing and the fact that quantum computers will most likely be in a position that allows them to easily break current cryptographic standards. And so NIST is working on quantum secure encryption standards. And the thing that caught my eye with regard to that report is that apparently the White House put out a report that said we want all of the US, especially the US economy, all the sensitive data and communication be encrypted in this new with this new method, so it's secured against quantum computing attacks until 2035, if possible, which is not a long time in the future. And I'm thinking, because I wrote something in that regard a couple of months ago in a report, and I'm thinking, what are we doing in Europe? Like, I'm not really sure. I know that, for instance, Germany is keeping an eye on this, and we've got government agencies looking into this, but I'm pretty sure we don't have a plan about how do we transfer all our communication into a space that is secured against the possible coming quantum computing revolution. That's something that I found very interesting that I just read this morning.
Do you think this is because of the lack of the foresight on part of Europe or the lack of the technology in quantum in general? What would be your take?
I think it's more a lack of foresight because we're not as bad with regard to quantum computing technology in Europe. Actually, we've got a couple of centers of excellence who are doing very well compared to the rest of the world. And we're also investing a lot of money. We've got great universities. I'm sure we've got like the man and woman power to be, you know, at the forefront of developing this technology. But it is, especially in Germany, a real hesitancy to look at these things that are developing in the technology sector and really go to the next 5 or 10 years and wonder, what would this mean? The thing that I was talking about before, like this whole cryptography issue, I think we're at a point where this is no longer even debated. I think it's pretty clear that the standards that we are using, like RSA, Diffie-Hellman, and all these kinds of things, they are susceptible to quantum computing attacks. The trajectory that quantum computing is on is clearly suggesting that we will be there in a couple of years, so that quantum computers can do what, from a cryptographic point of view, we're all afraid of they can do. And so now's the time basically to make plans and adjust and adapt to that development. And I don't think we're as agile as we could be in Europe or in Germany, especially with regard to these kinds of things.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. That's a great opening. Let's start with general issue of the autonomous weapons. And I can ask you for an overview where we are now, what are the biggest misconceptions about the area? Where is it all heading? What are the challenges? You know, what are the opportunities? The whole shebang.
The whole shebang. Okay. So biggest misconception up front, there are no autonomous weapons. There's only autonomy in weapon systems. This sounds like a super annoying and nerdy, you know, remark, but it's actually a huge difference. Why is it a difference? It used to be that when all of this started, I got into this field of work in 2007, so 15 years ago. And when all of this started, and even at the beginning, when the conversation at the United Nations started, which was a 2013, 2014, around this time, and this conversation is ongoing until today. And in the beginning, people thought, this is a new class of weapon systems. We can categorically like get a grip of what it is. And in the UN, even they coined this, to my mind, a bit, you know, awkward term, lethal autonomous weapon systems, which is then, from which the acronym LAWS is derived, which probably many have heard. The problem really, in terms of thinking about this in a categorical manner, is that autonomy in weapon systems is a function, and it doesn't really constitute a fixed category of weapons, because any weapon system can be an autonomous one in 1 minute, and then it can be no longer autonomous the next minute, depending on, you know, what the human decides this system should be doing or should not be doing. It is essentially autonomy in weapon systems, just a switch that you can flip, that you will be flipping or not flipping in the future, or a checkbox in the software that you tick. And if that is the case, and also if you're unable to, you know, inspect from the outside, look at something and say, well, this is obviously an autonomous weapon system, and this is a non-autonomous weapon system, the same way we did in arms control in the past with regard to, say, landmines, you could say, this is a landmine, I can see, this is a landmine, I recognize landmines when I see them. There might be different versions of landmines, but, you know, we've, you know, cataloged all of them, and we know all of them, and these are the landmines. And this is exactly what autonomy and weapon systems is not susceptible to, this entire approach. And so if you accept the fact that, you know, strictly speaking, there is no category of weapons that is called autonomous weapons, and, you know, that there's all that there's only autonomy in weapon systems, then all the questions and also the regulations, they change. The questions that you should be asking isn't how do we prohibit, regulate something, but rather how do we regulate the way humans and machines on the battlefield interface with each other and, you know, interact with each other, and, you know, who or what, human or machine, is controlling what and when. We've gotten there. So the scholarly debate and the diplomatic debate at the UN is at this point, but this was what, like, one of the huge misconceptions at the beginning, basically the question of what is it that we're talking about. But finally, eventually, we got there, and it is really, in effect, autonomy in weapon systems rather than autonomous weapons, even though, you know, we can use that as a shorthand and say autonomous weapons. If you know what is meant by that term, then it's fine, but I find it important to clear this up in the beginning.
All right, thank you very much. And this is actually pretty interesting. Why do you think that this misconception took place? Why, you know, is it a popular sort of or political shorthand, or does it have some sort of deeper meaning?
I mean, it signals the paradigm shift with regard to the way we shape regulation and the way we do arms control from a quantitative to the qualitative approach. You know, in the olden times, working on nuclear, things were comparatively easy with regard to, you know, counting warheads, counting missiles. These were tangible things that just sat there in the environment somewhere, and you could say, okay, this is like 10 tanks, this is 15 airplanes, and this is 20 intercontinental ballistic missiles. This is no longer a viable approach with regard to a couple of areas. Cyberspace would be one. Space to a degree is also one. And then the whole question of autonomy in weapon systems, which is essentially a software-driven realm. And if you can't, like, fix that category and say, this is the autonomous weapons and there's 10 of them, but rather you have to ask, like, how do we devise a paradigm of control with regard to weapon systems that have autonomous functionality, then you are in a very different area with regard to the language you have to use, the paradigms you have to use, the way you shape and make regulation. And it's just, diplomatic fora and also, like, the scholarly community thinking about these things, thinking about arms control, it just takes humans a while to adapt to these kinds of things. Autonomy in weapon systems is one of the things where you can really clearly see that shift, even, for instance, at the United Nations Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons in Geneva, which is where this thing has been, you know, at the forefront of the debate since 2014, and where processes in the past began, which ended up someplace outside the UN framework, but but where processes began that ended up successfully and that worked in the old ways. And I'm thinking specifically of the Anti-Personal Landmine Treaty and the Cluster Munition Treaty. Those started at the CCW in Geneva at the UN. They ended up outside the UN framework, but they worked by delineating clearly a specific type of weapon system that is supposed to be, in this case, prohibited. So there are all these old, you know, frameworks and blueprints and just, you know, ways to think about these kinds of things and how to, you know, enact regulation. And those had to be overcome and new answers, you know, needed to be found. And but we're pretty close to, I think, answering the key questions at this point. It's 2022 now. It took about 8 years. But even at the UN, I'd say the answers are there. The political will that would be required to implement these, that's a whole different, you know, question. I have my doubts that we will get anything out of this forum at the UN at this point. But I think conceptually speaking, we've made, you know, a lot of headway over the last years.
Okay. And before we move to the actual technology, what are the most significant competing approaches to the regulations? I mean, I can see that different countries, different regions, but also different companies would have different approaches to the sort of conceptual or regulatory framework. Are there some marked or important differences that play a role when negotiating this issue at the UN level, or I guess you know where I'm heading?
Again, I'd say we're seeing convergence, and I can explain why that takes place. But if we go back in time a couple of years, I would say there was a whole plethora of different ways of going about this. Like, obviously, you had countries who were saying something like, we don't have to do anything about this. This is science fiction. Why are we even talking about this? I'm happy to name countries, to name specific countries if you want. So Russia, for instance. Yes. Russia, from the get-go, was, in my mind, like the biggest spoiler state in Geneva. Like, they would be saying, why are we even here? We shouldn't be talking about this. This is nonsense. This is science fiction. While at the same time, Kalashnikov was showing a turret with a machine gun with autonomous functions, with, you know, autonomy in the critical functions of the targeting cycle. That was Russia for years and years, still is. Now they're blocking progress by saying, well, we can't travel to Geneva, and so it's so unfair, and we're, you know, terribly victimized. The international community is mean to us, and we can't go to the formal meeting, and so everything needs to be informal now because Russia is basically vetoing and torpedoing the entire process. I should explain the whole thing about, you know, critical functions and autonomy, but we can do this later on. And then you had a couple of other states like the US, for instance, Israel, South Korea to a degree, that just weren't very keen on doing anything that would be tangible. But the reasons were quite different. For instance, the US, they kept saying, look, folks, this technology, we're just developing this. We're discovering what, you know, what AI can do in this military domain. Let's not regulate anything. We're not sure, like, if maybe it could be prematurely, you know, cutting off specific things that we all find would be, you know, very beneficial. Like, for instance, to reduce collateral damage and all these things. Pumping the brakes, for sure, but with a very different rationale. And you have to say, the US, they have a doctrine on this, and they've had this since 2012. Like, they had regulated this domestically even before the UN started talking about this. So, I mean, say what you will about them, they've got a pretty good handle on this. You know, in recent years, a couple of middle power countries were extremely interesting in terms of the way they shifted in their position. And I'm thinking particularly of India. India, I think, is looking at this, or you know, has started looking at this very much in terms of a leapfrog opportunity for them, militarily speaking. I think they're looking at this and saying, wow, we can basically... this is such an enabling technology for our military. We can, you know, jump several generations of weapon development and procurement and just immediately go there and then, you know, have a big, big benefit. And so they were kind of like from on the fence-ish to they are now very much, very loud against it, almost Russian, noises that they're making at this point. Then, of course, there's a big, big group. Actually, it depends on how you count. It's at least 30 plus countries. And even if you take the non-aligned movement into that, it's more than 100 who are clearly coming out and saying, we're very concerned about all the risks that go along with that, that also we haven't talked about yet. And so we need regulation. And then again, you can differentiate between those that say, we want some soft law. Maybe we do something like a code of conduct or something like that. And those that say, no, we need a binding treaty that if you sign it, that is like new international binding law. And that's basically where we are these days. Yeah. And as I said, you know, even before the war, the CCW, the forum in Geneva, was not in great shape and everything was moving only at tectonic speed. But, you know, now with the war, everything is, you know, in a full gridlock. And why we've moved on in terms, conceptually speaking, and why there was convergence between all these groups that I just described is that the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is like the guardian of international humanitarian law, the rules and regulations for how to conduct warfare, they came out last year, I think, if I'm not mistaken, yes. And they formulated their own position, which is quite unusual. Usually they observe and they give like gentle hints, but they're not strong on this is what we should be doing with regard to international humanitarian law. They're a very conservative organization. They want to retain the laws of war that we have. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting, and it only happened a couple of times in the past, and whenever it happens it has a huge impact because everybody's looking at what is the ICRC doing, what are they saying, and they actually came out and said we need binding new international law, otherwise the existing law that our job is to protect will erode. Mm-hmm. We will lose, like, for instance, these key pillars of international humanitarian law, which is, for instance, we need to differentiate between who's a combatant, who's a civilian. You have to use only a proportionate amount of military force to, you know, achieve the mission, but not, you know, do unnecessary harm and all these kinds of things. And they're saying if we don't come up with good regulation for autonomous weapon systems, we run the risk of destroying this body of law that we have and that we all find very valuable and that actually we want to, you know, keep. And so they not only have this position, but they only made in my mind, like, very clever suggestion on how we should be going about this.
Now let's move, let's say, more to the technology side, but still there's a bridge. Let me ask, is there some sort of a time frame when there could be some sort of technological breakthrough which would really render the current international law framework useless? You know, is there some sort of progress which, if it takes place, then it's already too late? And then if you can, you know, in general, describe to us what is the autonomous function, where we are in terms of technology now, what are the risks, and why do countries invest into that technology? You know, let's say this is the guide for beginners in terms of autonomous weapon systems.
I think we're already past this point. So there is no big breakthrough that we, you know, need to wait for this to become a real, real issue. We've moved past this point. So that's another big misconception maybe that I can clear up. Actually, two birds, one stone. So misconception number one, autonomous weapon system is new. It's not. It's not new. And misconception number one, autonomous weapon systems is problematic. It's not. It depends. So that's also like a big problem for people who think about this as like the Terminator is coming. This is not what we're talking about. Unfortunately, you have to look at this in a very differentiated and context-dependent manner. And this gets quite complicated and thus, you know, hard for people to follow. And so these are two misconceptions. And you were asking like about the technology and how mature it is. Obviously, AI is very important in this. But again, just to reiterate, autonomy in weapon systems as a functionality is not new. We've had this since, I'd say, at least the 80s. It depends on basically where you start, historically speaking. But I'm thinking specifically of weapon systems such as, you know, the Patriot missile defense or the Phalanx gun on Navy vessels. that do a specific thing. And that is also like the opportunity to define what it is that autonomy in weapon systems is about. And what they do is they complete the so-called targeting cycle without human intervention. So if you want to know what an autonomous weapon system is, it is a weapon system that after activation completes the targeting cycle without human intervention, meaning it finds, fixes, tracks, selects, and engages a target. And that's what we've been doing since the 80s. You know, like, for instance, the Phalanx gun that you would have on a Navy vessel in the US Navy, or Goalkeeper, maybe the Dutch have something very similar, would be like a gun turret sitting on your ship, and then you flip a switch and then it looks for targets. And it has target profiles. It looks for specific things so that, that it thinks could be you know, harmful to the ship, that could be a danger. And if it finds these things and then those match specific criteria, the gun will fire and try to destroy that target without human intervention. And here already we can see that, you know, autonomy in weapon systems is not necessarily a bad thing, because we want these things, we need them, especially with regard to, you know, if we think into the future, hypervelocity missiles, you know, come in our way, you need a machine firing at these things because everything is just way too fast. But AI, and that's what we're seeing right now, you know, you were mentioning breakthrough, AI, I think, is like putting all these systems and this functionality on steroids, basically. It is an enabling technology, and I'm thinking specifically of two things, object recognition and sensor data fusion, which are just two things that make weapon systems so much more powerful. They can now they can look for targets in a very different way, in a much more powerful way, and you can have way more complicated target profiles for these weapons to look for. So that is true. And that is also why we need to be thinking really hard about regulating these things, because here's also how this can go sideways really, really badly. Because you were asking about the risks, and you were asking about like, when does it become a risk? It already is. I said we've moved beyond this point. If you think, for instance, about this, you know, specific type of systems that have autonomy in the critical functions, the selection and the engagement of targets, which we call loitering munitions, those have been around for about 10 years or so, some of them even longer, and they are proliferating like crazy. Like many, many countries are producing them now. You can buy them from Turkey or Poland, or like everybody's making them. For instance, the switchblade, for instance, that the US has been, you know, giving to Ukraine, those would also fall into that category of a loitering munition. And what it is that it's a, usually it's like a drone type smallish kind of thing that you launch into the air, and then it looks for targets. And here we are again with the target profiles. You could have something like the Harpy, for instance, which is an Israeli made system, which looks specifically for radar signatures. So you would launch this, and when the S-300 or any, you know, air defense system flips on the radar, the Harpy will, you know, find that radar and then home in on that radar beam and destroy the target, blowing itself up, basically. It carries a little warhead. It's like a suicide drone. You know, this is loitering munition, cruise missile, suicide drone, like the, it's a blurry boundary there. And here you can see where the risk is with these kinds of things, like weapon systems that we already have. Loitering munitions are a great example, that are autonomous in their critical functions. They don't really understand what they're attacking. And that's really the key distinction and with regard to a human operator. And this is really the key issue that we need to solve by coming up with the clever control paradigm for these weapon systems that use autonomy in their critical functions. The Harpy will dive bomb into that radar, you know, irrespective of what the circumstances are. And so if I put this radar on an orphanage or, you know, a hospital roof, this thing will just slam in there. A human operator wouldn't, because that would be, you know, breaking the laws of war. It would be a war crime. And so then this weapon system in a sense, would be culpable of a war crime. And then what do we do now? Like, then you have all the legal questions, like who's responsible? Is it the last person to activate the weapon system? Is it the manufacturer? Is it the country? So these are things that lawyers, you know, are struggling with these days. And this example is why the ICRC is saying, look, we've come this far, we've fought hard, and you know, we know the terrible suffering that ensues. We can see that in Ukraine actually on a daily basis. If we don't stick to these very basic rules of war, like for instance, don't attack civilians. Civilians are not targets in war under any circumstances, period. It's a very simple rule. And if we start using weapons that, you know, cannot ensure that this rule is followed, then we're eroding the body of law that we have. And this is a perfect example to basically show where we are right now with the technology that we have, and that there's no breakthrough that will, you know, take us across the Rubicon. I think we're like halfway through already.
Going back really just briefly to the application of AI and specifically image recognition, we are continuously faced with examples of AI not being very advanced in terms of recognizing objects. What does that mean in terms of the autonomous weapon? So the advancement of AI in terms of image recognition or object recognition in the autonomous weapons?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I can say with total, I'm 100% sure there's no magic sauce in military applications that somehow, you know, solves all these problems that we know.
Can you see a time in the near future where this will advance in either way, but to be able to be used, you know, let's say, more safely in autonomous weapons or in defense generally?
So the way I perceive all this is that we've moved from spin off to spin in the military domain. Like there used to be like high tech developments that maybe, you know, sometime down the road, they would, you know, spin off some sort of civilian application. Actually, much of this has been flipped around, and everybody's now looking at spin in and so-called civil military fusion. Like you want to draw on the innovation that happens in the private sector as quickly and as efficiently as possible, and you know, implement this in all your procurement processes from a military point of view. The US is doing this very aggressively with offices in the Silicon Valley, with approaching like the big tech firms. China is doing it because, you know, there's a lot more overlap anyway. There's no real distinction between this is a private company and this is the Chinese state in many ways. So like the membrane, let's say, is even more permeable in that case, because, you know, in the US we've seen like companies like Google say, actually we don't want to be involved in military applications of our technology. And so you have some friction there that doesn't necessarily apply for China, say, but it is clearly the same trend in all the big player countries. They want to, you know, apply all this innovation that happens in the private sector for the military. And it's the same in Europe too, by the way. And so if there is the notion out there that somehow in the military domain, all this AI is even better and they are kind of solving all these problems that, like, for instance, Tesla's autopilot did not solve this far, forget about it. It's at best, it's as good as the civilian applications that we have. Usually, I think it's probably not as good because they just don't get the talent. Like, if you're like super good at what you're doing, you go to work for Google or Tesla or, you know, Uber or whatever, like, or Waymo and all the others. And you don't work for like an arms manufacturer. Software, generally speaking, is terrible, terrible in the military domain. And so obviously then the problems are the same or even worse. You know, we've got all these problems with object recognition that we know of. Like, is it a school bus or a snowplow? Is it a turtle or a rifle? We've all seen the papers, right? And we all know that even today in 2022, the Tesla autopilot will run over a stop sign if you put some sticky reflective tape on it, because it somehow, you know, messes with the algorithm and the object recognition falls flat. And even though I think and I hope we can solve all these things, you know, from an engineering perspective with the self-driving cars, I'd say, you know, self-driving cars are, even though they turn out to be quite hard, a problem to solve, they are easy compared to fighting a war. Because eventually we will have an ecosystem where all these cars are friendly to each other, talk to each other, and, you know, manage the flow of traffic. Whereas, you know, fighting a war is the exact opposite. The systems on the other side and the people on the other side will do anything they can to mess with you. And so all these things that we know about, for instance, adversarial imagery, insertion, in, you know, flipping only like one pixel or tiny bits of a picture and then messing with the object recognition algorithm, you can think of all these shenanigans taking place on the battlefield then. And that will render these high-tech AI powered, you know, object recognition system quite useless quite quickly if you have a clever opponent.
We recently discussed this in our podcast about quantum computing and how quantum sensors will make a massive difference in being able to look, see through fog, see through rain, see through things that current autonomous cars, driving cars, yes, just can't.
Absolutely, yes. That's what. So object recognition is one big thing, and then sensor data fusion is, I think, also very big. And I hope I don't sound like everything you know, is terrible and nothing works. I don't think that's the case. Especially with the fusion, in the fusion, you know, domain, you can do amazing things already. Like, for instance, detecting, like for short range air defense purposes, detecting like small things buzzing around, like small drones, you can do fantastic things using AI by just merging your radar, your audio, your visual, and all these things merging together. And then you will find, there's a little drone buzzing behind this tree. And then of course you're in a position to say, okay, we've managed to find this target way better and much quicker than like any human with your Mark I eyeballs and your ears could. And then the question is what to do about it. And here we are again with regard to what to do about the critical functions. So let's say we found the target, we're fixing it and it's buzzing around and we're following it. What do we do now? And so do we select and engage it? And the question really is, who or what human or machine is supposed to make that decision? And the answer really is, it depends on the circumstances. If you're somewhere, you know, where, you know, out in the open, like for instance, on the high seas, I mentioned the Phalanx gun, it's just really, really unlikely that you would hit a civilian out on the Pacific Ocean. And usually also civilians aren't like metal tubes with a rocket motor flying Mark III, so right? And right. So it's really unlikely that you're, from a legal or even an ethical point of view, that you're in some sort of trouble there. So it's fine to have the machine fire away. And with the small drone that we were talking about, again, it depends. I can definitely see you know, scenarios where I could say the humans operating the system are fine from a legal and an ethical perspective to just put this system into an autonomous mode for a couple of minutes. Like if the system says we've got short range air defense targets buzzing around, and then humans you know, feel, okay, this is a serious threat that we need the machine to react to, and we are sure that nothing, let's say it bluntly, can go wrong, you know, then it's fine to just flip that switch and have this machine for the next minute or so shoot down everything that comes at them. And the way in the expert community this is pondered, basically this question is, what is meaningful human control? It's called meaningful human control. It's a bit of a mouthful, but the idea really is that even if you have a system that is autonomous in the critical functions, that selects and engages targets without human intervention, how is the human still able to foresee what the weapon will be doing? How is he or she able to administer while the machine is operating? And then if something goes wrong, can we you know, trace it back to basically who made the mistake, mm-hmm, by in this specific instance handing control over the critical functions over to the machine? So it's really important to understand that people like myself who say we need meaningful human control over weapon autonomy, we're not arguing for let's make everything remotely controlled. This is specifically and clearly not what is meant by meaningful human control. It is fine to have a weapon system in specific contexts operate autonomously in the critical functions, but it has to be in a way that the human human-machine relation satisfies all the legal and ethical criteria that we apply to the way we use weapon systems. So it's very much about, it's about responsible use of autonomy in weapon systems.
Okay. As we're coming towards the end, I'd like to move this into a bit more of an abstract discussion. You studied philosophy. How do you see philosophy and sociology playing a role and being created, and if there is one or several philosophies that are coming out around the topic of autonomous weapons? And I think this would be an appropriate time. I'll just read out the first couple definitions of philosophy from Google so that we get into the mood of what we're looking at. So, okay. So philosophy, the study of fundamental nature of knowledge, reality, and existence, a theory or attitude that acts as a guiding principle for behavior. Reading that out, would you say that you can identify possibly a philosophy or philosophies that might be coming out around the discussions, let's say defense, but mostly we've been talking about autonomous weapons. So let's stick to that.
The part of philosophy that is very important to keep in mind, and that could be helpful in this discussion, not only the discussion about autonomy and weapon systems, but more generally speaking, the way that humans and machines relate to each other in the 21st century is moral philosophy, right? And I think we can already see this in documents. For instance, the European Commission put out a new document on regulating AI. And one of the key things that you will find in these kinds of documents that's actually present also outside of Europe is like this notion that the machine should not render humans into objects. So we were talking about target profiles. And one of the things I'd like to make this specific, one of the things that the International Committee of the Red Cross, for instance, is suggesting is that we should not have something like an autonomous anti-personnel weapon by using biometric data as part of the target profile. Like, think of small drones buzzing around using target profiles that say kill all the blonde women or kill all folks with a specific other characteristic or look for one specific person, like facial recognition. This is just something that the IRC is saying, and it makes sense to me from a you know, moral philosophy point of view, and also from a legal point of view, because we in Germany have this in our basic law as the, you know, first rule to say you are reducing people to just a data point, and there's something fundamentally wrong with that. Like, the way the human and the machine are relating there is just, there's something very off about this. To have this decision to live or die made simply by an algorithm that is matching data coming from the outside with a pre-programmed target profile, there's just something fundamentally wrong with that. And I think we're finding similar notions in other ways that people are currently trying to find ways to deal with AI. And I'm thinking of, like, for instance, insurance cases. You know, the AI should not be, you know, making decisions, for instance, if you like what your insurance premium should be, or even like there's cases where AIs are, you know, are being used to decide like your jail time, or if you get bail or not, parole, and all these kind of things, parole, yeah. And so these problems that we're struggling with regard to AI, which would be, for instance, data biases and all these things, they apply the same way if we use it in weapon systems. And I think people have a very strong case, you know, against this background to say, you know, from an ethical point of view, and from a very broad sense, when we ask how do we use this responsibly, we shouldn't be using it to just feed human lives into a machinery and not concern ourselves about with who lives or dies.
You observe, obviously, these discussions also at like a UN level or an international organization level. Obviously, this is an enormous amount of new technology, of new innovations that we've seen in the last even 5 years, but definitely 20 years. Do you see people struggling with the new way of thinking about these things and the new acceptance of how these things even exist and how we have to discuss them, with so much of it being in the realm of, let's say, not yet being developed? We have to imagine, especially people that don't have the expertise in the technology, they have to sort of compensate by imagining what the results and what the creation of these technologies are. Do you think you can see them struggling with the concept of this being a normal thing to discuss, and that then the way they're able to discuss it being hindered by that?
Yes. I mean, the short answer is yes. People are struggling. Again, going back to the UN, the first couple of years in this room were spent, and in this room means like 100 and I think, what is it, like 120-ish, you know, states, parties, experts from the outside, and then, you know, academia taking part and civil society. Like, there's a whole campaign. It's called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, which is not only responsible for this being discussed in the first place, they put it on the agenda, but it has also been a very, very important voice in there by funneling scientific community voices into that room. And the first couple of years were purely spent with, you know, head scratching and talking about, what are we talking about? And it's like one half of the room was like, well, it's drones. And like all the, like the expert community was saying, no, it's not drones. It's much bigger than drones. It's everything. Everything will be autonomous. It's not just the drones. It's underwater. It's on the surface of the sea. It's on land. It's in cyberspace. It's in space. It's flying. It's everything. It's not just drone warfare. This is a thing that, you know, drives me crazy. Still today in 2022, people say, so you're talking about drones. And I'm like, no, I'm not talking about drones. I'm talking about autonomy in all weapon systems. Everything will have this. And so that was a problem. And then you had the other side of the room. Those people were basically thinking, well, we're talking about Terminators, like humanoid robots, you know, stomping on the battlefield. And that is obviously also not what we're talking about. So it took years and years for people just to wrap their head around the fact that basically what we're talking about is a functionality that is enabled by software and that changes the way that humans and machines, or in this case, weapons, interact. That took a while.
And I want you to think about this in an anthropological sense. But Okay. Can you imagine how long it will take from now, 3 years, 10 years, 20 years, for that room to have a much better fundamental or foundational understanding that they can start from, rather than now where half the room doesn't know what, you know, thinks they're talking about different things? How long do you think it'll take for, and let's use the UN as an example, for them to have enough common foundational knowledge for that discussion to be more productive?
I think the room was pretty close to that. Obviously, you know, not everyone. And then you have like weird mechanisms in the diplomatic realm. Like, people will just change posting after 2 years or so. And then someone new comes in and, you know, she used to do like something about visas in Nigeria, you know, before that. And now she's posted in Geneva and people are explaining to her like autonomous weapon systems. And obviously, you know, that takes a couple of days or maybe weeks to catch up. And so there's always like new people coming in. And so you lose knowledge in a sense. And so as someone who's been in that room for 8 years from the beginning, I have seen many things just being rehashed and just talked over again and again. And I'm thinking, why are we going through this again? Well, it's new people and they are hearing all of this for the first time. And so in the end, it all comes down to leadership and basically political will. I think, for instance, that room would be at a point in terms of convergence, conceptually speaking, where you could move forward, but we are basically at a low point with regard to political will. I think nothing will come out of this. This process will probably go someplace else. It might be in the United Nations. It might be outside the United Nations, the same way it happened with cluster munitions and anti-personal landmines. But at a specific point in time, you need people to take the reins and say, most of us now know what we're talking about. Most of us are pretty sure what we need to be doing about it. There's great suggestions on the table. Now let's move and negotiate the actual thing that we want to have out of this. Be it a treaty, a regulation, some sort of document, whatever, a product, I don't know, what have you. And you know, that is not the case. And so all the conceptual convergence is nice and fine, but, you know, eventually you have to move to a place where you just bring it to a conclusion. And that is usually the problem with these kinds of processes, arms control in general, and, you know, specifically the UN. As you say, you know, quantum might bring, especially sensing, not computing, but sensing, which is in some parts, you know, close to maturing, will bring another big leap forward and change the game again specifically. And I think we will probably need another 8 years in some UN forum to wrap our heads around this and say, well, what does that mean now? And we're, generally speaking, my answer is diplomacy is way, way too slow to keep up with the way that technology is moving. That is just the fact of the matter.
I couldn't agree more with that.
For the end, we're currently in the process of organizing our annual Next 100 symposium. Every year we've been focused on the future, and the common question has been, where do you imagine the future of your area of expertise or your area of interest to be in 30 years? Where do you want it to be in 30 years? And what are the practical steps to get there? This would be a massive question. It could just be a whole nother podcast. But if you could briefly sort of reflect on where do you think in 30 years this area will be, and then where do you actually want it to be, and what do you think needs to change in our steps currently for us to get to the better version?
There's one general trend that I see for the next 30 years, and that is the hype breaking. That's something that we didn't get into before, but I think many of the things that people expect to be a benefit of autonomy and weapon systems will turn out to not deliver. I think there's a big hype, you know, around all things AI in the private sector, and that has had spillover effects into the military domain. People would say, well, it's awesome, it's autonomous, it can do this, that, and the other. And, you know, technologists who actually know what the technology can do and cannot do will tell you, nah, that is just overpromising, and basically this is just, you know, public relations also by companies, for instance, wanting to sell, for instance, their loitering munitions, saying it's got facial recognition. That, for instance, you know, Cargo 2 is by a Turkish manufacturer, you know, it's openly advertised on the internet of being able to do that. Most people say we don't think it can. Now, so I think we will be going down the other side of the hype curve also in the military domain. And so there will be some applications of matured autonomy and weapon systems where AI is playing a role. It's super interesting, by the way. The US, they have Jake, it's called Joint Artificial Intelligence Command, and they have a whole department that is only about testing, validation, and certification. And so they have come up with a quite, you know, rigorous scheme of testing and then certifying AI applications, and they are not even close to certifying anything that is at the, you know, sharp end of the spear. So, you know, regulating the AC, fine, but, you know, firing a weapon, nah, we're not there yet. And so this will take a while for these things to be implemented, to be procured, for people to have trust in them. You know, at the end, the soldiers on the ground need to trust these systems. They need to be able to operate them and, you know, be sure that they do what they want them to do. And only that, nothing else. And all these kinds of things. That takes years and years and years. That would be the one thing that I would say which will happen in the next 30 years. Also, like simple countermeasures that probably we can't think about right now that might be able to easily defeat your multi-million-dollar AI-enabled super fighting machine. Like you see the Ukrainians, not necessarily that they're fighting a high-tech opponent, but you see the Ukrainians being like very smart about the way they fight, and they can defeat an opponent who has quite clearly like more in terms of quantity. And so these are the things that I can foresee in the next 30 years or so. What do we need to do to come out at the good end of this? The bad end would, of course, be like this proliferating or diffusing more, like from everywhere to everywhere. And basically, you being, under the constant risk out on the street of just being, you know, blown to pieces by some loitering munition that some psycho has put in the airspace. You know, we do not want to live in this kind of world where basically the whole globe is encircled by an artificially enabled, autonomous, moving anti-personnel minefield. And so if we manage to at least curb this development and put the clamps down on specific ways of maybe even like developing and selling this kind of technology, but most definitely like establish strong norms against using it, not in specific ways, but using it in a responsible manner that I was describing before, like having meaningful human control and so on and so forth. Then I can see us, you know, coming out in a way that we're not necessarily in this dystopic scenario, but that it's just kind of a normal thing that happens in the military the same way that we're using all kinds of AI things, whatever it is, in our daily lives. Yeah.
I'm so glad you turned that around, because I was worried we were going to end up encompassing the world in danger and fear. So I'm glad you didn't finish there.
And that's what I usually do. I try to change it up a little this time.
Thank you for listening. The Global Arena Research Institute specializes in high-level research and analysis using big data and AI. In our podcasts, we bring you experts from various fields for fascinating and useful discussions. Until next time, have a great day.